transcribed.
Reminiscing, I feel you near. Once more, you're my love of yesteryear.
Howdy, folks.
Yes, it is your old friend Singin' Sam. So let's just settle back and reminisce a bit. What do you say, huh?
With a nostalgic nod toward the Atwater Kent, we now present Same Time, Same Station, a chronicle of broadcasting's first half century.
Return with us now to those thrilling days of yesteryear. With the speed of light, a cloud of dust, and a hearty "Hi-yo, Silver!" The Lone Ranger. This is the legend of a man who buried his identity to dedicate his life to the service of humanity and country. It is the story of the origin of the Lone Ranger. Early settlers in the West had to be brave men and women, ready to fight for their lives at any moment. There was danger on every side. There were wild beasts, savage Indians, and the Cavendish Gang. Butch Cavendish headed a pack of outlaws. They struck without warning to steal and kill.
Open fire on that wagon train! Wipe them out to the last man!
The Cavendish Gang attacked ranches and towns as well as wagon trains. Everyone feared Butch Cavendish. His gang grew rich and powerful. Finally, the Texas Rangers learned where Butch Cavendish and his gang were hiding. Six Texas Rangers guided their horses along a canyon floor to arrest the Cavendish Gang. Presently, Captain Reed signaled a halt.
Rein in, boys. We'll wait here until a scout returns.
Do you think it was a good idea to send Collins, our guide, on ahead?
It was Captain Reed's younger brother who asked the question. The captain explained that Collins, who was not a Texas Ranger, was the only man who knew the country and who could scout ahead for information. Then, while the Texas Rangers waited for the guide's return, the captain said to his younger brother,
"My wife and son are coming from the east. If something happens to me and you survive, well, I know you'll take care of her and Danny."
"Right.
I'm going to count on you to resign from the Rangers and work that silver mine we staked out. See that my son and his mother get my share."
"I promise."
"Here comes Collins, the scout."
Silly.
What's the word, Collins?"
"Good news, Captain Reed. It's all clear. I scouted the rim on both sides of the canyon and found no sign of the Cavendish outfit."
"All right, boys, let's go. Get up there.
Collins, the guide, lagged behind unnoticed by the Texas Rangers, who moved in single file along the floor of the rock-strewn canyon. They didn't know that Collins had lied, that Butch Cavendish and his killers were waiting in ambush on the rim on both sides of the gap.
"Here come those Rangers, boys, just as Collins told us."
"Yeah, they are." "Right.
Now, we can't get down to the floor of the canyon without going a long way back, and it'll be dark in half an hour. So we'll just keep pouring lead into them from up here until we're sure they're dead. Then we won't be taking any chances. Now open fire!"
The Rangers leaped from their saddles and spread out as they returned the fire from both sides of the canyon. Soon, four of the Rangers were killed. Captain Dan Reed and his brother, wounded several times, kept fighting side by side. Then the captain fell, mortally wounded, and a moment later, his younger brother, the last of the Rangers, slumped to the ground. The outlaws waited and watched for any sign of life from the Rangers, then rode away, convinced that all six men in Bryant's Gap were dead. Sunset came, then darkness.
Thank you.
Indian examined the bodies by moonlight. After examining the first five men, he muttered softly,
"Oh, them dead."
Then he came to the sixth man, the younger brother of the captain.
"And this man, alive."
The Indian lifted this man tenderly in his strong arms and carried him to a nearby cave where he bathed and dressed the wounds. Then he took a spade from one side of the cave and returned to the canyon, where he worked steadily until the dead men had been buried. Returning to the cavern, he sat watching through the remaining hours of the night. Daybreak found the ranger stronger, but by nightfall, the wounds had become infected. The Indian called on all his knowledge to treat the wounded man. He went day and night without rest. It was the morning of the fourth day when the ranger opened his eyes. And for the first time, the Indian saw them clear and calm.
"Are you weak? Me glad."
"Yes, I... but so weak."
"You wounded, man."
I remember an ambush."
"That right? Me find you in canyon. Carry you here to cave."
It's daylight."
"It morning."
"Then I must have been unconscious all night."
"It's several days since fight in canyon."
"Several days."
"Ah.
There's something familiar about you."
You remember? Many year ago, you only boy. You find Indian boy in trouble. You save life, Indian boy."
"Yes. Your name is Tonto."
"That right."
"Years ago, you called me Kemosabe."
"That right. And you still Kemosabe. It mean faithful friend."
"Tonto, there were six of us in that canyon. The others. What about the other rangers?"
"Other ranger, all dead."
"Dead." "One was my brother."
"You only ranger left. You, lone ranger."
"The lone ranger." "Tonto, those killers know me by sight. If they know one man escaped, they'll look for him."
"And them not know one escape. Tonto bury five men, make six grave. Crook think you die with others."
"Good. Then my name shall be forever buried with my brother and my friends. From now on, my face must be concealed. A disguise, perhaps, or a mask. That's it, a mask. I'm the only one who knows about the Cavendish gang. With your help, Tonto, I'll get every one of those crooks."
In the ranger's eyes, there was a light that must have burned in the eyes of knights in armor. A light that through the ages lifted the souls of strong men who fought for justice, for God.
"I'll be the Lone Ranger."
That's a condensed version from a child's record of the 50s of how it all began on network radio in 1933. The Lone Ranger, emanating from Detroit, became easily the most popular program of its type during radio's first half century. But the Ranger and Tonto never rode across the ether of more radio stations than they do today, at the start of radio's second half century. Because today, the transcriptions of the series are syndicated to over 150 stations by Charles Michelson, International Broadcasting of New York. One of those stations is KFI here in Los Angeles, where the Ranger is heard each Sunday night at 7:05. Tonight, then, the story of the program from the time it evolved in the mind of George W. Trendle, owner of an independent radio station in Detroit, as a means of competing with the city's network stations. Soon the Ranger was carried by WXYZ in Detroit, WGN Chicago, and WOR New York. And the telephone lines used to distribute the live broadcast became a new network, named Mutual. Meanwhile, the Ranger adventures continued.
This is the legend of a man and a horse and how they met. The story of the Lone Ranger and his great horse, Silver. The Lone Ranger and Tonto were trailing the worst outlaw in the West. His name was Butch Cavendish. They had followed his trail for many weeks, until finally, they noticed that the hoofprints of the outlaw's horse were fresh.
We're close to Cavendish now.
Yes, Tonto. He can't be far ahead.
Him outrun us last time. Maybe better we shoot in sight.
No, I want to take him alive. That shot.
Look out.
Steady there, steady, boy.
Over there. Killer in ambush. Him right way.
Tonto, he missed me, but he shot my horse. Get after him.
Get him up, Tonto.
Tonto's horse was tired and no match in speed for the animal Cavendish rode. The outlaw escaped. When Tonto returned from the futile chase, he found the Lone Ranger standing beside his dead horse.
A good horse, Tonto. Loyal, faithful, and brave. But my next horse must be faster. I wish that... Tonto, we've heard stories of a wild horse, a fiery white stallion.
Him seen near valley over there, where Cavendish go.
We'll be on the lookout for the wild horse while we follow Cavendish.
Tonto's horse carried the Lone Ranger's saddle, his saddlebags and bridle, while the masked man and the Indian continued on foot along the outlaw's trail. When they reached the top of a hill...
Look, Tonto!
They halted suddenly and stared at an awe-inspiring sight far down in the valley. They saw a great white stallion in a death fight with a giant buffalo. The horse was plunging, rearing, charging, and dodging wildly, and the sun flashed from his coat as from a coat of polished silver. They realized that this was the legendary white stallion, the one ranchers and hunters had talked so much about.
Tonto, we must have that horse. I'll try to shoot the buffalo.
It's too far for pistol shot.
I'll get closer before it's too late.
As he ran downhill, the Lone Ranger watched the battle. The sleek white stallion was nimble and courageous, but his strength began to wane. The buffalo charged again and again. The splendid muscles of the white horse were slower in responding, then too slow. He was caught by the buffalo's charge. Wet crimson stained his pure white coat. Another charge. The white horse saw it coming, and he couldn't dodge. He staggered and fell. The monster drew back and lowered his head for the death charge. And then, two shots rang out. The buffalo shuddered from the impact of the masked man's bullets. For an instant, he stood motionless. Then fell. Battered and bruised, the white stallion lay quietly as the Lone Ranger bathed his wounds. During the next several days, the masked man and the Indian cared for the injured horse. Then the wounds were closed, and the horse's strength had returned. There was once more fire in his eye, a spring in his step, and his head was lifted proudly.
Otto, he's himself again.
Him plenty strong, plenty good horse.
I wonder if he'll take a saddle. Let's try. Steady there. Steady, boy.
Me get rope. Him run away.
No, Tonto, wait. Let him go. I'd like to have that horse more than anything in the world. But he deserves his freedom. He fought for it.
Him stop.
He's turned to look at us. See how the sun reflects from his white coat.
Him look like silver.
Silver. That would be a name for him. Silver! Look at him. Silver! Hey, Silver! Tonto, he's coming back. It's just as if he knew what I said. Silver! Silver, you beauty. Hand me the halter, Tonto.
As the mighty stallion felt the halter, he trembled as if from a chill. Every instinct told him that he must flee at once to preserve his freedom. And yet he stood his ground. It wasn't gratitude that kept him there. It was something stronger, some mysterious bond of friendship and understanding. He heard the man's voice, and he liked it.
Silver. Silver. We're going to be partners.
Him let you use halter.
Now, Tonto, the saddle.
Oh, no horse like that. Take saddle.
There never was a horse like this. Now, Silver... We're going to work together.
The horse was wild and unused to the ways of men and the weight of a saddle and a rider. But the masked man was a kind teacher. He was gentle yet firm, and Silver was intelligent. The stallion seemed to sense the desires of the Lone Ranger and did his best to cooperate. He learned quickly, and after several days of training, he was ready.
Follow me, Toto. I'm going after Cavendish.
Come on, send him there!
No hoofs had ever beat the plains like those thundering hoofs of the great horse Silver. During the past few days, Cavendish had gotten far away, but the masked man and Toto trailed him relentlessly with only a minimum of rest. It took days to cut down the outlaw's lead, but at long last, Cavendish came into view.
There he is. Come on, Silver!
The mighty stallion responded with a new burst of speed. Cavendish fired wild shots over his shoulder until his gun was empty. His horse, though powerful and fast, was no match for the charging Silver.
Get up
there.
Come on.
Fear and panic filled the outlaw's face.
There.
He heard the hoofbeats ever nearer.
Get on
and then
there.
The masked man shout.
I want you, Cavendish.
The masked man's avowed mission was accomplished. The last of the Cavendish gang was captured to be tried by law and punished for his crimes. But there were many others whose criminal plans were to be challenged by the Lone Ranger, his faithful Indian companion Toto, and his great horse Silver.
I'm Silver! Aye!
That's another Decca children's record issued to capitalize on the popularity of the Lone Ranger, and another condensed version of an early milestone episode. Before we hear from some of the men behind those voices, let's hear another important part of the Lone Ranger story.
I'll Silver!
A fiery horse with the speed of light, a cloud of dust, and a hearty Hi-yo Silver! The Lone Ranger! This is the legend of Dan Reed, the story of how the Lone Ranger found his only living relative. A long line of prairie schooners moved westward through a valley. Among the pioneers were families with all their worldly goods and men on horseback who planned to seek their fortune in the new frontier. Also, there were several women who had joined the wagon train to meet their husbands, who had previously gone west to make new homes. Suddenly, a blood-chilling cry rang out from the hills.
Indians!
Brilliantly painted Indians charged from the hills on both sides of the valley.
Form a circle with the wagons!
Get to the floor of the wagon, honey, and hold the baby close.
Heavily outnumbered by the Indians, the pioneers knew they had no hope, but they were determined to fight to the last man. It was the following morning when the Lone Ranger and Tonto came upon the scene of the massacre. They drew rein and examined the grim remains of wagons that had been looted, then burned, and the bodies of brave pioneers who had died in their attempt to conquer the West.
No survivors, Tonto.
It looked like work of Apache.
This must have been the wagon train that was heading for Fort Laramie.
While Tonto watched, the masked man made a detailed inspection of the ashes of wagons and their contents. Presently, he found a small square piece of metal, a nameplate from a trunk. He wiped it on his sleeve, then read it.
Tonto, remember how the Cavendish gang ambushed my brother and the other Texas Rangers in Bryan's Gap?
Me know. You ambushed, too.
I think my brother had an idea that something might happen to him. Just before we rode into the gap, he called me aside and said...
I want to speak to you brother to brother. My wife and son are coming from the east. If something happens to me and you survive, well, I know you'll take care of her and Danny.
I promised him I would. Then he said...
I'm going to count on you to resign from the Rangers and work that silver mine we staked out. See that my son and his mother get my share.
I made arrangements for an old man named Jim to work the silver mine and got enough ore to keep me supplied with silver bullets and what cash I need.
Me know.
We were to wait until my brother's wife arrived from the east to decide what she wanted done with her share of the silver mine. But now I...
Me sorry, Kimasabi.
Yes, Tonto. Linda and the baby boy were on this wagon train.
Maybe woman, baby captured. Maybe them alive.
It's a faint hope, Tonto. Nevertheless, I shan't be convinced that they're dead. We'll always be on the lookout for some clue that Dan Reed and his mother are alive. In the meantime, we must help make the West a place where massacres like this can't happen.
After reporting the massacre of the wagon train to Fort Laramie, the Lone Ranger visited his secret silver mine for a fresh supply of silver bullets. Now Frisbee held the box in her thin, blue-veined hands while she told of coming west in a wagon train.
That was over 10 years ago. There was a fine lady traveling with the party, and she had a baby boy.
The dying woman told about the Indian attack.
I crept away from the scene of the massacre and took the baby with me. I came up here near the border and raised Dan as my grandson. Here's a little gold locket that he wore around his neck. There are pictures inside.
The Lone Ranger opened the locket and looked at the faces of the man and woman as Dan spoke.
I wonder who my parents were.
I know them. This man, your father, was my brother.
Your brother?
He was a captain of the Texas Rangers and one of the bravest men in the country. Your mother was a fine lady from Virginia. Her name was Linda.
I called the baby Dan because it's the name that's on the locket. But I never knew the last name.
Dan's last name is Reed, the same as mine.
Gosh!
I've been looking for you, Dan, for many years, ever since your father died. From now on, if you're willing, we'll travel together.
Oh, I'd like that.
I'm glad. Would you do just one thing for me before I sleep? Would you take off that mask and show me your face?
Why, of course.
Oh, it's a good face. Yes, a good face.
Dan, your grandma was a fine woman. It's too bad she had to go.
She was certainly good to me.
She and your father left you a great heritage.
A heritage?
Yes. They and others like them have handed down to you the right to worship as you choose and the right to work and profit from your enterprise. They have given you a land where there is true freedom, true equality of opportunity, a nation that is governed by the people, by laws that are best for the greatest number. Your duty, Dan, is to preserve that heritage and strengthen it. That is the heritage and duty of every American.
Fred Flowerday, the longtime director of the Lone Ranger radio series, now operates a recording studio in Detroit. When Brace Beamer, who played the lead, died in March 1965, Fred assembled members of the radio cast to pay tribute to the man and the program. Here is that tribute, as broadcast in Detroit in 1965.
This is a tribute. A tribute to Brace Beamer, better known to all of us as the Lone Ranger. He entertained millions of us as we grew up. He was, to an entire generation of people who were weaned on radio drama, the voice of honesty, justice, and law and order in the Old West. As you know, all of us were shocked and saddened when Brace Beamer died suddenly earlier this week at the age of 62. He will be very much missed. And his booming voice, uttering the familiar cry of...
I owe silver away,
will always strike a nostalgic twinge for all of us. Mr. Beamer was born in Mount Carmel, Illinois, on December 9th, 1903. At the age of 14, he enlisted in the Army to become the youngest soldier in the American Expeditionary Forces in World War I. He then served 111 consecutive days in the trenches in France. He began his radio career as an announcer and an actor in Indianapolis in 1922, about the same time radio had its birth, by the way. He came to Detroit with WXYZ in 1932, and the following year, the Lone Ranger made its debut on the air. In a recent interview with Mr. Beamer, I asked him how long he had been with the Ranger.
Well, I made the first appearance on a horse in 1933, the same year it started. And the pictures were all of me and the entire show.
He was, however, not the only Lone Ranger.
You see, we had three Lone Rangers.
Right now, who were they, in order?
I think the first one's name was Deeds, if I'm not mistaken. Now, I could be, but I'm pretty sure I'm not.
He was the Lone Ranger for a relatively short
time. Very short time. Then George Seaton, as you know.
Right.
Then Earl Grouser, who was killed. And I think, I'm not sure the year I went back in, 1938, I think. I played the last 17 years.
The second most important character on the Lone Ranger was Tonto. Tonto, his faithful Indian companion, played by John Todd. Were they close personal friends in real life?
Not very, no.
You
weren't? No, we were friends, but we weren't friends socially. John had his group. John was a little older than I was.
Uh-huh.
You see, John was in his 80s when he died.
That's right.
And he had his classes, and he had his drama classes, which I wasn't at all interested in.
So that great camaraderie, that classic friendship was strictly confined to the show, right?
Oh, that's correct.
Tonto and the Mask Man.
I eat kemosabe.
Listen, Brace,
yes.
Tell us, what does kemosabe really mean?
Tai means hail in Potawatomi. Kemosabe means faithful friend, so put them together. Tai, kemosabe, hail, faithful friend.
Beamer was a man of great good humor and loved to tell these stories about the man who played Tonto.
John Todd loved to double parts, and he had several voices.
Yeah.
And he liked to double an Englishman's part. So one time, he's doubling this Englishman in the same show, and he's riding on the stagecoach. And a jackrabbit's supposed to run out alongside the stagecoach. John is supposed to say, "I think I'll chance a shot, you know." And he's making the motion with his hand to give the appearance like I'm doing now, riding, you
yeah.
see.
Yeah,
And he's supposed to shoot. His next line is, "Ah, a hit." Instead of that, when the director threw him the cue, after the shot, he said, "Ah, a cue." There was another funny one. The Tonto and I were up in a hotel room searching these outlaws' luggage and baggage and so forth and so on. And at the end, I'm supposed to say, "All right, Tonto, there's nothing here. Let's get back to camp."
Uh-huh.
And John says, "Ah, kemosabe. Get him up, scout." We're in the second floor hotel room.
Another voice familiar to the millions of Lone Ranger fans was the voice of the narrator, Fred Foy. You'll recall his stirring introduction. It went like this.
A fiery horse with the speed of light, a cloud of dust, and a hearty hi-yo silver. The Lone Ranger.
Fred Foy is now with ABC in New York, and we contacted him by phone yesterday and asked him about Brace Beamer.
Well, I can say, number one, he was a good friend and, to me, a wonderful person because he carried over the character of the Lone Ranger into his personal life. In fact, to me, he was the Lone Ranger, whether on the microphone or off. And he brought this character to life to a great deal of youngsters, both on the air and off the air. I know it was one of his prime purposes to visit children's hospitals, where many youngsters, of course, idolized the Lone Ranger. This was to them a real life hero. And there were many instances where, in just going in his full regalia as the Lone Ranger, the mask and so on, that this would give these youngsters quite a tremendous lift. And he was just, to me, a very good friend and a wonderful person, and it was quite a shock to learn that of his sudden passing.
The second part of Brace Beamer's career, as we all know, developed just a few weeks ago. A series of commercials were produced with his voice, and some nostalgic moments from the Lone Ranger program itself. Well, the man whose idea it was is here with us tonight, Don Dolan of Young and Rubicam Advertising Agency here in Detroit. Don, when did the idea happen, and how did it come about?
Well, about 3 or 4 months ago, which was, I think was about 2 months before we started to put the stuff on the air, we did a demo tape with Brace for another product.
Uh-huh.
And because of his style of delivery and so forth, it never developed. But then we were asked by our local clients, they wanted to do something that sort of pinned down the fact that Chrysler was started here, was still built here, and so forth. So one thing led to another. We said, my goodness, Brace is living out in Oxford and the star of a show that originated here and made good nationally. And so we just naturally tied the thing. It was Detroit's hometown car and Detroit's hometown radio show. But can I say one thing?
Sure.
Well, which I'd like to. The day that we called up Brace and asked him to do this, there's only one thing he said to me. And he said, sure, I'll do it if it's in good taste. And this, to me, sums up the whole man.
You know, the thing that amazes me, the Lone Ranger went off the air the last time in 1955, and I can't ever recall hearing Brace Beamer's voice since then until this period. So, was it who discovered, that Brace Beamer was in Oxford, Michigan, and how did the name pop up again? Was it your idea? Did you dream it up one night? Or?
No, the basic idea was my idea, but Brace, we were all aware of Brace being around. But we felt that, I don't know, for some reason we figured that, he just wouldn't want to do something.
Well, he had been in retirement.
Yeah, sure. And if we figured he wanted to stay with his horses and not be bothered, coming in and out of town making commercials. But I think, at least Brace indicated that he was having a heck of a time when he was doing these, because he was really enjoying it.
Yeah,
and,
we can tell that when we talk to him.
So it was a great privilege on my part to work with him, because like you and like everybody else over 30, I think that this man is an inseparable part of your childhood.
There were naturally hundreds of people connected with the Lone Ranger in one way or another during its first 22 years on the air. And we have some of them with us tonight to reminisce about Brace Beamer and the program. And many of the voices you will recognize immediately. We have the actors with us, Paul Hughes, Raleigh Parker, Jay Michael, Ernie Winstanley, one of the early directors on the program, Chuck Livingston, Fred Flowerday, one of the latter-day directors and a man who's been with the show for a long time. Chuck, I think, In terms of longevity with the show, is the oldest among us right now. Not in terms of age, Chuck.
Oh, that's true, too.
When did the Ranger start? Were you there?
I wasn't there at the beginning. It started in January of 1933, and I joined the company or the cast around August of 1933.
So it was just a few months old.
Yes, and Brace at that time was chief announcer and studio manager of WXYZ.
What were you doing when you joined the cast?
I was an actor, and Because of my voice, I was the heavy on most of the early Lone Ranger programs.
You played a lot of heavies in your day, didn't
in
you?
In fact, from, I would say, 1933 to 1938, when I was fortunate enough to become the dramatic director of the Lone Ranger, I believe I played more heavies than any other man in the United States.
Whose idea was the Lone Ranger? Now, you were there just a few months after it began.
Well, I believe the story, which I believe, is that George W. Trendle wanted to create a character, a Robin Hood character with a Western background.
Uh-huh.
And I think that was the basis for starting, and I believe then that Jim Jewell, who was then director of the Lone Ranger...
Was he the first director?
Yes, he was.
Yeah.
And he searched around and came up with this writer from Buffalo by the name of Fran Stryker. Mm-hmm. And Fran had been writing a play with a Western character, not based exactly the way Mr. Trendle wanted it, but from that they got together and The Lone Ranger was conceived.
And when it started, was it on a regular three times a week basis, or how was it run?
Yes, sir, it was a 7:30 in the evening play, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. I think it always remained that way. And it developed the it was the originator of the Mutual broadcasting system.
That's right. I understand that they developed Mutual only because to accommodate the Lone Ranger.
That's right. They wanted it. Gordon Baking Company had purchased the show, and they wanted it in the Chicago market, the Cincinnati market, the New York market, and the Detroit market.
What was Brace Beamer's affiliation with it in 1933?
In 1933, Brace was the narrator, a very important part of the Lone Ranger show.
Fred Flowerday, who now takes care of all the Lone Ranger tapes and guards them with his life, has them locked up in a vault, has been with the show for a long time, too. When did you start, Fred?
I started in late 1934.
What were you doing?
I was hired by George W. Trendle, and he sent me down to see Brace. That was the first time I saw Brace, and Brace was then station manager. And so Brace sent me up to see Jim Jewell, who was then director, and I started in doing sound effects, opening and closing doors, and working with Ted Robertson, who was then the chief sound technician, and...
I understand. By the way, I think I should point out that at that time, Fred was nothing but an acne-faced young teenage boy.
Right.
Tell us about some of the sound effects. Now, in those days, there weren't any recorded sound effects, were there?
No, most of our sound effects were done manually. I mean, we had a large sound effects staff. I think there were four at the time when I started, and our gunshots were done manually. We had no recorded gunshots.
How would you do a manual gunshot?
Well, strangely enough, the first gunshot was a rat trap that was fastened to a large thunder drum.
Uh-huh.
And on cue, when a gunshot was called for, why, one of us would spring this rat trap and it would go on the thunder drum and give the effect of a gunshot.
Well, you couldn't do any rapid firing, could you?
Just as fast as you could work this rat trap, I presume. But then we went to an improvement over that. We had large cardboard boxes that we would use and hit these boxes with a stick. The famous series of gunshots, the six at the opening, were done by a sound technician as he hit this large cardboard carton.
Tell us about some of the other early sound effects, the horse's hooves.
Well, the hoofbeats progressed in the same way the gunshots did. They were done manually, of course, and they always have been. But we did the rhythm of the horse's galloping on our knees with our hands, and then it progressed.
How would you do that? You would just slap your thigh?
We'd slap our thighs. That's a bad gait right there. I'm not used to doing
that. Will take it to Belle Isle and have a little...
And we did that, too, didn't we, Raleigh?
Yes.
And then we took... We would hit our chest with our hands in rhythm of the
That was a very soft turf.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then from that, we went to the sink plungers, the short-handled sink plungers that we would clop together in rhythm, one against the other. And then as we were continually trying to get better sounds, and I think we prided ourselves in our sound department. Our sound effects, we tried hard, and I think we got some good ones. But we went to a gravel box that was filled with gravel, a foot and a half deep, and we would... vertically plunge the sink plungers into the gravel to give us the sound.
It sounded like a horse galloping down a trail. And sound effects were so much a part of radio drama. As we all know, it's all imagery. It's what the mind envisions. And I can't imagine anybody listening to a Lone Ranger program ever think of when they heard the horses galloping of a couple of plungers in a box of gravel.
Well, we changed the terrain, too. If we had the ranger in town, we're going in sandy soil, why, we would, if it'd be one box, part of the box reserved for that particular material. If they were going through underbrush, we would put broom corn to give the sound of the horses going through. We even went so far as the director called for the sound of the bridle as we would...
How would you do that? With a leather chain and a bell? Or a piece of leather and a bell? Or
yeah, we'd... we actually had some bits of a bridle that we would hold in our hands. So when the horse is galloping, why, we'd have the jingle in time with the gait of the horse.
Well, when the horse would jump a chasm from one mountainside to the other, about 40 feet.
How would you do that?
We'd just stop galloping, Jay.
Then pause.
Then Fred, when the horses went over the bridge.
We would switch from the gravel box to other side and be down on a wood floor, and we'd invert the sink plungers and do the hard wood handles on the sink on the wood floor to give the sound of the horses.
Fred, who would give the cues for all this? Now, you had one director, and Chuck was the director at the time. You were doing most of these manual effects. Would you have to cue the actors and the sound effects people all at the same time?
Yes, sir.
It took a lot of synchronization.
It did.
To keep your fingers crossed.
Well, this group and these boys, they worked show after show after show, and they became used to this method. It was different than most dramatic shows, and that we had a separate studio for sound effects so that we could set a level that wouldn't drown out the voice when the actors were in a different studio.
Mm-hmm.
And this way we kept a balance between the voice and the sound so that it was easy to understand. We also had a problem, remember, with the music, Fred? When the Ranger first went on the air, there were complaints that the music was too loud. Well, the engineers were carrying this at a zero level. And on their, what do they call that?
Volume control.
And the music, even, it wasn't slopping over the zero, but it was too loud, and we'd get letters of complaint, and Mr. Trendle would get at us. And finally, we decided the thing to do was to hold the music at a -4 and peak the voices at zero. And from that time on, people did not have to touch their radio sets when the music came on and pull it down.
Chuck, speaking of the music, the William Tell overture, for as long as any of us live, will be not the William Tell Overture, but the Lone Ranger theme. Was it always the Lone Ranger theme? Was it the first one?
They tried, one time they did try the Light Cavalry Overture, but this didn't carry the feeling that they wanted. It was the only one that was used on the air.
One of the most celebrated and publicized change of voices, you'll recall, was when Bobby Breen's voice changed. Another one, equally important and equally traumatic, I'm sure, to the guy involved, was the man who played the Lone Ranger's nephew, Dan Reed, Ernie Winstanley. When did you start as Dan Reed?
Well, in early 34, right after Chuck. As a matter of fact, Chuck used to pick me up out in Orchard Lake and bring me in corduroy knickers. And I played that for about 3 years, as I recall, 2 or 3 years, and my voice changed, and then I graduated into the sound department under Fred. I had been doing a little bit of sound.
How did they write you out of the script, Ernie?
Well, they didn't. There were about, all told, as I recall, 5 or 6 different Dan Reeds.
I see.
He was not in every show, of course. He was in maybe 1 out of 12.
That's right.
It had to be a heartbreaking experience for you when you find your voice getting lower and lower.
Well, I think he kind of liked it because then he got to play these young manly juveniles, these handsome heroes.
Well, Ernie, you actually grew up with the Lone Ranger.
Oh, yes.
And tell us about the different parts you've played. Proceed from where you were Dan Reed after your voice changed.
Then I played mostly the dashing young juvenile, right, Salatella?
Always a good guy?
Pretty much in those days, yeah.
Oh, sure,
until,
cavalry lieutenant.
Until 1941, when I went into service, and then when I came back, Chuck started me playing just all different types of characters, as we all did. You never knew what you were going to play until you appeared at rehearsal. You had no idea what character
you were. Well, we all did ad lib.
That voice, ladies and gentlemen, belongs to Jay Michael. Jay has one of the most easily recognized voices, I think. You all will recognize it when you hear him speak. How long were you with the Ranger?
Well, I hate to say it, but I arrived on the scene about 29 years ago.
Yeah. And how many different parts do you figure you played?
Just about everything. I think I played more villains than anything else, though. But
you were classified as a heavy.
A heavy, yes, right. Because a heavy voice, you can't do much with it to lighten it up.
Well, I know you played some old-timers.
Sure, I played old-timers.
But in later years, Chuck was Black Bart originally, and then Jay
was Black Bart.
Were you the Lone Ranger's arch-rival, Black Bart?
Oh, yeah.
Give us the Black Bart voice. Do you recall it?
I'm telling you, masked man, I got you covered with this gun. One move and you're out of the picture, you understand?
Wonderful.
Oh, shut the hell out of my hand.
You know, now that brings up another point. All of you who are actors on the show had to go through these tremendous sounds indicating to the audience listening that you were doing something physical. You were getting shot or you were in a fight. Would you do this just naturally as you were doing the script? Was it indicated in the script? In other words, if you were socked, Black Bart.
Oh, no, they didn't put sock in the script, no.
All right.
Well, there's a man standing in front of you with a pad and a fist, and he'd go like that, and you'd take an immediate reaction. Oh, and you'd back up a little bit as if you fell back.
Yeah.
Then come in again, and a lot of times the fights would be going back and forth from there. This fight.
When you approach,
you always, whoo, there, whoo, yeah. And you just smile.
Would you also get breathless, right, if you're in a fight?
Oh, scene? Yes.
You'd just do this automatically.
We even had footsteps, and you entered a bar on the floor.
Yeah.
Man walking across. Sometimes they said, well, you couldn't hear a man walking across a bar. It's noisy, but we had him.
Well, they had spurs on and things like sound floor.
Well, due to this physical work they did, we always played an arm's distance from the microphone. We never crawled up close to the microphone because you couldn't react physically if you were that close to the microphone.
Another one of the most easily recognized voices in the country is the voice that belongs to Paul Hughes. Paul, when did you join the Ranger?
Oh, I'm just one of the newer members. I think came in about 1939.
Yeah. I always recall you as the sheriff.
Yes, you never knew from day to day what you were going to do.
Yeah, but most of the time you were a good guy, weren't you? Weren't you on the side of law and order most of the time?
I'd say about 50% of the time. I'd kill one day and doctor the next.
Yeah. I think one of the characters that Paul developed was very familiar to everybody was the Thunder Martin.
Thunder Martin,
yeah.
No.
Yeah. Tell us about Thunder Martin. Who is he now? I don't recall it.
Give me a little bit of that, Paul.
Well, Thunder Martin was the
Wally Berry character.
Wally Berry character.
Yeah. Was he a good guy or a bad guy?
He was a good guy, yeah. Always getting into trouble.
Uh-huh.
The thing that impressed me particularly about this show, just to get off another tack, When I first came up here, I came from what they might call a soap opera station down in Cincinnati. And it was a speed. I remember my first spit. I had a well in the butt on the second page. On the second page.
You had to do what, man?
Huh? Yeah, just two broken speeches. One was a well and one was a butt. I remember turning away from the microphone to the top of the page to clear my throat. When I came back, they were way at the bottom of the page. I never did get my well and butt.
We never worried it.
Raleigh Parker is another familiar voice to all of it. Raleigh, I think you were on almost every Lone Ranger episode I ever heard.
Not quite that many.
How many do you figure that you did?
Well, it's hard to say. Over a period of 19 years, maybe twice a week. What would that be? Quite a few.
Oh, 1,500.
Yeah, a lot of them. Now, you were generally... Well, of course, you were split up, too. But I seem to remember you as a good guy most of the time. We're trying to separate the good guys from the bad guys tonight.
Well, as we say when some novice asks you, what did you do on the Lone Ranger? The only answer you can give is... Good guy, bad guy, Chinese cook, Mexican, old man, young man, banker, lawyer. Chuck had us rotated so that each time we came down to rehearsal, old boy, just a short part, but it's an old man.
Yeah.
Next time, a long part of a villain, sometimes.
You did a lot of dialects, really.
And didn't you all do many different parts in any given Lone Ranger episode?
Oh, yes.
Frequently.
Well, I wish Raleigh would tell the story. Raleigh, doubled Tonto quite a lot when John Todd was on vacation.
Unfortunately.
I think he got a very funny story about the woman that called after a broadcast.
Oh, during one of John Todd, who was a fine Tonto, during one vacation period, somehow or other, Mr. Livingston, Chuck put me in a Tonto for a couple of weeks. And after one show, I was lousy. After one show, there was a phone call Chuck told me about. He tried to coach me and help me. I can't use the word, but the lady said, That's an Indian?
Is that the only time you played Tonto for those 2 weeks?
4 weeks altogether. Then that was it.
Did you just soon forget that period?
You sure would.
How would you do several different parts in one show? Would you ever have one speech as one character, for example, and then, you know, run into yourself? In other words, have a conversation with yourself?
No, they're written sometimes that way, but the director, Chuck Livingston, would fix it so that you'd have plenty of time to go from,
well, howdy, ma'am,
to something like, that's enough out of you now. You couldn't do it immediately, but he'd have some other speeches in between.
You know, most of those Lone Ranger episodes were done live. There was no tape in those days, so they had to be, you know, they had to be perfect. There was no fluffing allowed, and there were very few.
Fluffing allowed?
There must have been some interesting, maybe amusing experiences that you guys remember. Tell me about them.
I can tell you one. You might have forgotten, you fellas. John Hodiak, who's not with us now, he got a line as a big hero as he backed up to the mic to say, I'm off to the execution. And at the time, he was taking voice lessons. And he said, I'm off to the elocution.
Now, it would seem to me that would send a nervous cast into gales of laughter.
It would.
You guys didn't even react.
Sometimes, but when you look at Chuck's face in the control room, you soon regained your poise.
was he a little blue in the face?
A little bit, or you disappeared down below the counter.
How about some of the other, you know...
Let me tell one of my mates that Grace told on an interview last year. Of Frank Russell, dear soul, played character parts with us, was playing a sheriff one night. And he and the posse had located the gang of crooks, and it was at night, and they had their little camp in a circle surrounded by a forest. Well, Frank deployed his men all around a certain signal. They were all to come in, and he would say, all right, gents, get your guns up. So the time came, and he stepped on the clearing. He says, all right, gents, get your gents up. All right, gents, get your gents up. I'll shoot them.
And you always recovered. Now, did the script... It was always timed, of course, to run just a half hour, wasn't it, Chuck? Exactly?
That's right, yes, sir. We were fortunate. I don't believe we ever ran over one strip. This is network.
Was there ever a time when you had to cut some lines?
Oh, yes. Sometimes we had to cut quite a bit.
Well, how would you do this? How would the, you know, when would you, you were doing this live, and I assume
oh,
you
no,
decided to cut the lines right then and there?
Oh, no, this was to...
Chuck, I think it'd be interesting to give a sort of a production schedule as how we did the show. These actors came in with a cold script, Joe. They never...
Right.
Had seen it before the rehearsal was called. It was just give a...
We had 3 hours to do the show.
Right. What time would the actors get there?
Well, let's see. Was it 3:30 that we started?
I think 3:30.
We'd take a reading, which took approximately 1 hour, and then the timing would take
1/2 hour, because we would have our script cut down to just about the size that we needed.
Uh-huh.
Then we would have a break. Didn't we?
Casino break.
Everybody can relax.
And then the production rehearsal. That's where we put the sound effects and everything in it. This took 1 hour. And then a 1/2 hour for dress rehearsal.
And the dress rehearsal is... But presumably you'd have everything chopped down to time.
Everything was timed the way we used to time it, every 15 seconds, and at the time at the end of the scene, and the time at the beginning of the next scene. And we also backed up from the closing time that we had to have, and we had a deadline that we had to meet,
uh-huh.
which meant we either had to speed them up at times or slow them down. We had a system of signals, which they all understood, and they were different probably from the normal radio station drama. It sort of mixed up actors that we'd pick up. We would come in, and they wouldn't understand that when you took your hand and brought it down, palm toward them, flat, that meant slow down, and when you turned your hand the other way and brought it up, that meant pick it up.
Pick it up or slow it down.
And when you wanted them to get back to their normal tempo, it was a horizontal move of the hand, which meant go back to normal.
How was Brace Bremer to work with as an actor and as a man, Chuck?
As a man...
You've directed him for many years.
Brace was one of the finest individuals I've ever had the fortune enough to know and work with. He had a heart as big as he was. And he was a man's man, let's say, and he was opinionated. He definitely had his ideas on how certain things should be done. And naturally, in the stress of rehearsals, we used to come to differences of ideas, but Brace's ideas were entirely set on what the Lone Ranger would feel and do. He was the man... physically, he was the man mentally, and he was the Lone Ranger in his heart.
He really was, wasn't
yes.
he? When he went, now I talked to Brace Bremer just a couple of weeks ago, and I asked him the same thing. Where did Brace Bremer stop and the Lone Ranger start, and vice versa? And he told me that as soon as he went home, he was no longer the Lone Ranger. But everybody I talked to, all of you people who worked with him, say that was not so. That he was the Lone Ranger always.
He was. His feelings toward people, his interest in people, and the things that he did for people followed right straight through with the Lone Ranger's character.
He was a great humanitarian. I don't think any of us, Joe, can not recall at one time or another that he hadn't done something for us.
He believed... Sorry, Joe.
No, go ahead.
He believed in the ideals of the Lone Ranger. He carried them through in his life outside the studio.
Chuck, you were telling me before we started here, reminiscing about an instance you recall that probably vividly and dramatically demonstrates what we're trying to say about Brace Bremer.
Well, this happened at the time we had a contest, and there was one city in the United States was picked to change its name to Lone Ranger Frontier Town for one day. And this happened to be Cheyenne, Wyoming. And Brace had to be out there to make a personal appearance. And we all went out on a train, and in Chicago we changed trains, and the news had gotten along in Illinois, I think, that we went through, and Brace got out at the platform between two of the cars and looked out the window, and as he came along in these little cities, little towns, there were, I would say, groups of from 40 to 200 children, school children, that had heard about this, and as he came by, they'd all wave at him, and he waved his hand at them, and I stood there watching him, and golly, the tears were just streaming down his face. It was something which I shall never forget, and definitely demonstrates the feeling that this man had. And Brace did never felt that it was honoring Brace Bremer. Well, it was in a way, but this was a salute to this person, this character which he had created and had played so well and so long.
Mm-hmm. That's a beautiful story. Paul, do you have any particular... memory that you'd like to talk about tonight, an amusing incident or anything in your many years with the Ranger?
Oh, many of them. I can't tie it down to any particular one either.
How about the pay, Paul? Was the pay pretty good in those days?
Sure was.
This might be interesting to people. What now? See, it's 1938, and you're all gainfully employed actors on the Lone Ranger. How much did you...
Well, in those days, they didn't... That wasn't bad, but golly, when I started, it was $2.50 a show.
$2.50 a show. That was in 1933.
Yes, sir.
We got $10 for the Ranger, and that was with two repeats. We did the show three times a night.
Yeah, once for the once for here, the East Coast, once
West
for Central,
Coast.
And then for the West Coast.
$5 a show and two and a half.
I'm glad to get it, Joe.
Joe and Jake could say, I think there were five or six actors under contract. Johnny Hodiak was one. Jay was another.
Al Hodge, Bruce Beamer.
For $45 a week.
He was a high paid fellow.
That was for doing... I think about 12 shows. Because
we did
many
we did three
shows
Rangers a week in those days.
Yeah. Actually, nine.
I'll never forget the day. I was under contract of 40, and so was John Hodiak. And we went downtown. Our contracts were being renewed. John said, you go up first. So I went upstairs and talked to Mr. Campbell, his then vice president. And he started pulling out the files and showing me letters he had from all of the country people who were cheaper than we were getting. I cried a little bit. And finally, I said, well, I might as well sell insurance. And I started to walk out. He said, I'll give you 45. I said, sold. John Hodiak went up, and they wouldn't give him a cent more. And he went to Chicago, and there became a movie star.
What were you thinking when you walked out?
I won't say nothing.
Well, I can tell you that Fred and I got 12 and a half a week.
Sound effects, man.
Mm-hmm.
$12.50.
Was that your start, friend?
I think it was just about that, yeah.
Of course, you fellas didn't use your voices, though.
Yeah, I doubled many times.
You were just wearing out your hands with the plungers in the box of gravel.
Yeah.
For years now, ever since the Lone Ranger went off the air in 1955, Fred Flower Day and Ernie Winstanley have had every day to pass by a file drawer full of these magnificent old tapes. And I'm certain that on every day that you guys walked by them, you must have thought, when can we get it back on the air? What are the prospects now? Is there any chance? I know that it's running in several stations around the country.
Yes, and I hope it's going to run a lot more. There have been a total of about 32 stations who have contracted to rerun these Lone Ranger shows, which are all on tape. The quality is good, and the interest has been excellent from stations in New Jersey and Phoenix and in the South, New York State.
Mm-hmm.
And every day we have inquiries from other stations wanting to know if it's available for their market. And I sincerely hope that the Lone Ranger will still ride for a good many years.
Yeah, he certainly will with all of us anyway, Fred. You know, I remember, I guess, more about the ending of the Lone Ranger shows than I do now in retrospect about everything else. And as I mentioned before, I always recall... the ending of the show would always end the same way. The evildoers, of course, had been brought to justice. And generally, the bad guy was getting arrested by the sheriff. And there was another guy there, too. And the bad guy would look at either the sheriff or the other fella. And he would, you know, be startled and very put out because he had been taken in by this masked man. And he would always say, you know, who was the masked man? Could we recreate that now with Paul and Paul Hughes and J. Michael and Raleigh Parker? Raleigh, you be the bad guy, okay, who's getting arrested by the sheriff and you're put out. Paul, you be the sheriff. And Jay, you be the bystander, the town mayor. All right? Okay, now, Raleigh...
Who was that masked man?
The masked man? I don't know. Who was he?
Why, that was the Lone Ranger.
Reminiscing, I feel you near once more.
Be with us next week for another nostalgic look at radio of yesteryear.
And now it's just about time we were picking up our memories and moving along our way. I hope you've enjoyed listening to these songs and the memories that go with them as much as I've enjoyed bringing them to you. And I'll be keeping my weather eye peeled, yes, sir, looking for you all to join us the next time we drop around this way for a friendly little get-together. And I hope that'll be real soon, folks. And until then, this is your old friend Singin' Sam saying goodbye for now.
Same Time, Same Station is produced for KRLA News and Public Affairs by John Price. Special research by Martin Halpin. And I'm Bill Browning.
Be sure to be with us next week at this same time, same station.